The Encyclopedia of Ordinary Human Sensation, Volume 1, Pains, edited by Lydia Gibbons. Pain of central chest muscles, very nearly a sensation of fibers being torn, pursuant to certain especially violent acts of sneezing. Unbidden memories of one's deceased parents, very often colored with a vividness and intensity that outdoes one's daily sensory perceptions, and accompanied by feelings of remorse, longing for reunion, and a sense of matters never to be finished. Faint ache, quality of pulsation, just above one's eyebrows, quite as if one had, unconsciously, spent hours glowering with concentration. Tender sensation in right kneecap, most noticeable while walking out of doors, a component of this sensation's peculiar stat being the irregularity of its comings and goings, viz., that it will manifest for a number of steps, intensifying almost to a quality of burning, before retreating quite as suddenly as it came, leaving its possessor in a state of anxious unease. Realization that said tender sensation is unlikely to improve of its own accord, and is, in fact, more likely to worsen and to act as a harbinger for pains both excruciating and various, afflicting body parts vastly more difficult to look beyond than the knees. Disappointment in oneself upon realizing that said tender sensation, despite consisting in point of fact of frankly negligible quantities of pain, has nonetheless darkened one's outlook considerably. The act of drinking water from a glass that has been left on a table for rather too long a time and has, in consequence, acquired a taste quite like the smell of an unswept corner of a room. The sensation of gazing into a mirror and finding oneself appalled, viz., realizing that were this face to appear before one on the street, one would, without hesitation, inwardly enumerate a great many flaws, this initial start very often being followed by the further and equally dismaying realization that only a certain wishful generosity of self-perception, even perhaps a state of delusion, has allowed one to look in a mirror all these many years without rendering a similarly severe series of judgments. The recognition that one is, according to all sensible scriptural and psychological definitions, vain. The rather debilitating sensitivity beside one's fingernail that results from the too vigorous extraction of a hardened or pointed protrusion of skin. Quite the majority of dreams, viz., dreams of plummeting from a considerable height, dreams of finding oneself an object of fun, dreams of having regressed, either in chronology or in circumstance, dreams of having mislaid an object of tremendous import, dreams of being separated from a beloved person, frequently with associations of mortality or tremendous shame, dreams of conducting quite furious arguments, nearly always regarding matters that appear minuscule or, frankly, incomprehensible in the morning's light, and which tend, nonetheless, to color one's daytime relations with one's dream combatant. Dreams of sexual congress with strange and unwelcome partners, which tend, similarly, to color one's waking interactions, lending commonplace interactions a quality of nearly intolerable embarrassment. The sudden dread that overcomes one in the wake of certain dreams, particularly those that are, for reasons of psychic self-protection or circumstance, interrupted prematurely, and the consequent sensation of having glimpsed through a doorway ordinarily shut, and beginning already to shut again, a thing both terrible and true.
Four. The story we were told about Hannah's predecessor, Jim, to the extent we were ever really told one, was that he'd left because of a personal crisis. He'd been director for 4 years, beloved by the writers, tense somehow with Donna and the museum's board, and then something had happened in his personal life. A breakup, maybe? A sudden illness? And he'd gone back to Poughkeepsie, where last anyone heard he was volunteering at a children's museum. Donna occasionally alluded to disagreements they'd had. Jim had wanted to do an exhibit on Wright's interest in water cures, which Donna thought was ridiculous. But all in all, his name came up strikingly little. We'd seen a picture of him. It was still on the special events page of the Wright House website, which looked like it was, and may in fact have been, designed on GeoCities. He was wearing a too-big beige blazer, posing with his arm flung around a startled-looking woman in purple. He looked like a long-serving, not especially beloved, high school history teacher. A thin gray beard, a corduroy shirt that was probably missing buttons, a crooked smile. The only time Hannah or I ever referred to him was when we heard something in the house, the walls moaning in the wind, a thump upstairs. This was, although I can't quite remember how it started, one of the jokes we had, that he was plotting to get back into the museum, maybe hiding out in the basement. "Jim's pissed tonight," I'd say. "I think he wants his Pert Plus back." Hannah once left a chocolate chip cookie on the mantle as an offering to him, the way you do for Santa Claus. That's what I expected him to stay for us. A private joke. A name on a stack of business cards in a drawer. But that October, as it started to actually get cold, Hannah's fragility, her remoteness, her weepiness, whatever it was, got worse. And her capacity to make or appreciate jokes basically disappeared. She went from sleeping poorly to, many nights, sleeping hardly at all. Some of this, I figured, had to do with the museum. Visitorship had declined from minimal to near nothing. An evening reading event that she worked on for weeks was attended by just me and Donna. And some of it may just have been seasonal, the general unnervingness of fall in the country. The line between romantic getaway and lonely, creepy farmhouse is, it turns out, fairly thin. The yard and woods around the museum were carpeted in curled brown leaves. The windowsills were scattered with dry, dead flies. Driving back to the house from the grocery store, we wouldn't pass a single other car. If it weren't for the smell of fires burning in fireplaces, we might have thought everyone in town had been raptured away. Hannah had stopped waking me up when she heard things at night, but as often as not now, at some point after midnight, I'd hear her stand up and leave our room. This would always be in the absolute dark when I was thickly asleep, so I would only register it blurrily. Sometimes I wouldn't notice that she'd left at all until I reached over and found her side of the bed empty. In the morning, she'd be back, and when I'd ask her how long she'd been up, she would just make a noise that meant she didn't know, then roll over to get a few minutes of sleep before the museum opened. Lack of sleep seemed not to be affecting her quite how I would have expected. She was shaky, preoccupied, but she was energetic, too, in an unsteady way. She came to me one afternoon, after weeks in which we'd hardly mentioned our wedding, with a heavily underlined 10-page printout about catering options. Then, the next day, she told me to disregard it, that she was working on another. On the occasions when visitors did come into the museum, her tours went longer than I'd ever heard them. I'd hear her voice through the floor. "It's crazy, right? The weird thing, maybe Donna already told you, is that we don't even know if he ever meant to put them in any kind of order. He may just have wanted it to be jumbled up like this. Did you already see his study?" She'd started exercising, too. Dislike of the gym had always been one of our bonds. For her, this meant a pleasant softness around the hips. For me, it meant wheezing at the tops of stairs. But now, she was running each morning, out along Culver or on the little trampled path by the river, starting to get the prominent collarbone look of the scarily fit. It was to try to help her sleep, she said. It was to give her an appetite. I walked back across the fields behind the museum one Saturday after breakfast, and she was sitting on the riverbank in her gym clothes, her headphones in her lap, looking out at the water, sweating. "Are you okay?" I said. I just saw a heron, she said, not looking at me. He was up on that branch, and then he just sort of dropped down and whoosh. I was going to take the canoe and see if I could find him. At the museum, the amount of work she did seemed to be in inverse proportion to the number of visitors we had. She wanted to form a partnership with the library. She wanted to plan a textiles exhibit. She was constantly in her little office under the stairs, scribbling in her notebook. One afternoon, Hannah came down from upstairs carrying an old cardboard staples box. Donna, who'd been sitting reading at the welcome desk, leapt up. "Where'd you find that?" she said. I thought he would have taken it with him. "Careful, I wouldn't be surprised if you find old tuna fish in there. The guy was a first-class slob." Hannah walked right past her. The box, which had belonged to Jim, was spilling over. Hannah had found it in the back of the storage closet. She carried it into our room, where she dropped it in the middle of the rug with a dusty thump. There wasn't tuna fish, but there were, piled in no discernible order, years of printed-out email correspondence, receipts from paint purchases made at Williams Lumber in 2008, flyers for the 2009 Spring Harvest Festival, notes on a lecture someone had given at the Rhinebeck Historical Society about 19th century surgical practices, minutes from museum board meetings. "You found his miscellany drawer?" I said.
"I think I found his brain."
She spent the rest of the night sorting through it, covering one edge of the rug in our room with little stacks of paper organized by subject.
"Look,"
she said, holding up a piece of notebook paper covered in a drawing. I was at the sink, cleaning up after a spaghetti dinner, of which Hannah had taken 5 bites. The drawing looked like what a medieval person might have made of the solar system. Concentric circles, dotted lines, scribbled labels. In one corner there was a dark patch where someone had written something and then blacked it out. Across the top there was an 845 phone number in faded pencil.
"What could this possibly be?"
she said. It was the happiest I'd heard her sound in weeks. "Maybe he doodled when he was on the phone," I said.
"Here's another,"
she said, unfolding a paper with a smaller, equally incoherent drawing. The next day, the papers were packed up, the box back in the storage room. That, apparently, was where Hannah was spending most of the time when she couldn't sleep. "Organizing," she said. "Reading old papers, of the museums, of rights. Going through the collection. Thinking through how she could change the museum's marketing." The storage room was, with the possible exception of the basement, the room in the house that I liked to go into least. It had been a baby's room once, apparently, tiny and yellow, with bowing walls, a slanted ceiling, and so many notebooks and binders and banker's boxes that you could only make your way into it sideways. And it wasn't only papers in there. There were tools, broken mops, a bike tire, a taped-together bundle of what looked like banister rails. Hannah had wedged a little red cushion against the wall on the floor to sit on. The windows were covered with some sort of vellumish material to keep light from damaging anything. I imagined her up there like an ant in its chamber, piling and rearranging, piling and rearranging. "Do you want me to help you?" I asked her one night. "You could read out loud and I could transcribe. It would go faster."
"No, I'm not going to make you do that," she said. "No reason for both of us to be up."
That night, or the next one, I happened to wake up when the clock said it was 3:14 in the morning. Hannah wasn't in bed next to me. I decided, with the same sort of half-conscious lurch as when you decide to get up and pee, that I was going to go up and check on her. I really wasn't trying to sneak up on her. But I was aware, as I climbed the narrow stairs, that I was setting my feet down carefully. The hallway upstairs was dark, but there was a light coming from the half-open storage room door. There's a way to walk across a creaky floor, just pressing at the edges of your feet, such that it doesn't make a sound. I wouldn't have guessed I knew how to do it. Without saying a word, without pushing the door any farther open, I moved my head to look inside, and Hannah was on her cushion, on the floor, reading something in her notebook. She clapped it shut. "You're spying on me?" "I wanted to see what you were doing up here." She was standing up now, the notebook pinned under her arm.
"Well, I'm reading. Congratulations. Go to bed."
"Why are you..."
"Just go to bed. I'll be down in a little."
She sounded annoyed with me, but something else too. Embarrassed? Scared? A little apologetic? Couples should carry dry erase boards for writing messages to each other. Their voices convey too much. I did go back to bed, and a few nights later I was in the bathroom, rifling through the shelves in search of my tooth guard, when I came across her pill bottle. Hannah Rampe, Risperdal, 1 milligram. Take one pill every 24 hours with water. The bottle was full, heavy as a roll of dimes. The refill date was September 24th, and it was now October 25th. My body reacted to this discovery faster than my mind. A cold current ran down my legs. I knew, of course, that Hannah took medicine. I'd watched her place the little white pills on her tongue. I'd witnessed the weekly filling and snapping of her pill case more times than I could count. But I only realized now how long it had been since I'd last seen her take one. Her weekly pill case on the shelf below was empty. Maybe this was just a backup bottle, and she had her real one in the bedroom. Maybe she'd been taking them on a different schedule lately because of her trouble sleeping. I walked into our room, holding up the bottle. I knew I needed to get this moment right. Not a dad confronting his daughter with her stash of pot. Not a husband catching his wife in a lie. Just a man wanting to get something straightened out. A minor confusion. She was kneeling by the radiator, adjusting the valve, and as she turned around, I watched her expression change from a smile into a defensive scowl. "Are you still taking these?" Her doctor, she said, had switched her onto something else. It wasn't my business when. Since when did I monitor her medical treatment? No, I couldn't see the new bottle. Was I serious? When Hannah lied, there was a thing she did immediately afterward with her face and voice. A kind of snapping shut. Then she'd always move on with unnatural speed to some neutral, innocuous subject that had supposedly just come into her mind. This time, she asked me if I'd remembered to turn off the lights in the exhibit cases upstairs. I didn't fight. I didn't press. I told her I hadn't, and so I trudged upstairs, feeling somehow both as if I'd caught someone at something and been caught at something myself. I switched off the lights before coming back to bed. Those next few days, Hannah treated me with a deliberate, almost apologetic gentleness. She showed me a new set of places she'd been thinking about for the reception. At dinner, she made a point of finishing her slice of the undercooked apple pie I'd made. Donna had gone apple picking a week before, and now we had apples piled on every surface in our room, enough to feed all of Hibernia. She seemed so mild and normal that I decided I'd probably been wrong. She really was on a new medicine, and she'd just, for whatever reason, been embarrassed to tell me about it. Maybe the only actual thing the matter was that she was engaged to someone who treated her like the subject of a police investigation. We were standing out in the woods by the Wrights' gravestones when Hannah burst into tears and told me that she'd been lying. This was at 5 o'clock on a Friday, just after the museum had closed after another day without visitors. We'd come outside to hang paper decorations in the trees. The house's spooky Halloween festival was that weekend. And to see if Edmund and Sarah's graves were in good enough shape for kids to do crayon rubbings. The sun was slipping down between the trees, and I was crouched in front of Edmund's grave, trying to hold the piece of tracing paper still. Hannah's wail was so sudden that at first I thought something had bitten her.
"I lied to you," she said. "I lied to you. I'm so sorry. I haven't been taking anything. Something's wrong with me."
I rushed to her. A jumble of crayons and cardboard ghosts and pieces of tracing paper fell out of her hands as she started to silently weep. And, not knowing what else to do, I put my hands on her shoulders and started in on the useless automatic script. What's going on? Are you okay? Everything's fine. What's happening? Don't worry. I felt, all through my body, a kind of microscopic expansion, like a million little antennae raising. The first thing she said once she'd gotten so she could speak again, by then I'd ushered her back to the museum, and we were sitting side by side on the front porch, was,
"What if I'm not okay?"
"You are okay," I said. "You just need to be taking your medicine. We're going to go inside, and I'm going to call Dr. Blythe." Dr. Blythe, the therapist from her post-college breakdown, was not a name I'd ever spoken before.
"What if we get married, and you're stuck taking care of a crazy person for the rest of your life?" she said. "What if I marry Todd Lincoln? I would ruin your life."
"I've always seen a little of myself in old Abe." She snuffled a laugh through her dripping nose, then started to cry again.
"Do you hate me for lying to you?"
"No. I'll hate you if you don't take better care of yourself."
"This hasn't happened before," she said. "I'm not sleeping, and when I do, I'm having the weirdest dreams."
"What kind of dreams?" But she just lowered her head onto her knees and turned her face away from me. From the shuddering of her back, I could feel that she was still crying. After what felt like 15 minutes, long enough that the sun had set completely and there were goosebumps on our arms, she sat back up and said,
"Are we going to be okay?"
"We're going to be fine," I said. "We're going to go inside and call Dr. Blythe. I'm going to make us dinner while you take a shower. Then we're both going to get in bed and get a good night's sleep." But that wasn't what she meant.
"Are we going to have a happy life?" she said.
"Of course we are."
"What are you talking about? We're going to have a great life." "We already are."
She nodded quickly, trying not to cry again.
"Don't tell my parents about this, okay? I don't want them to be scared. Promise."
I nodded, and then I watched her face break.
"They should be nicer to you," she said. "They should be happier for us."
"It's okay," I said. "They will be. They'll be just fine. Let's go inside and call your doctor. Let's stand up."
"Let me call, okay? Let me call."
Helping her inside reminded me strangely of the nights, there had only ever been a handful in our relationship, when she'd had too much to drink and I'd had to steer her into our bedroom, lower her onto the bed, help her off with her shoes and tights. Once she was in her office chair, phone in hand, I stepped out into the hall and closed the door. Her office was just a little room underneath the stairs, and that moment, standing alone on the other side of the door, feeling my pulse synced up with the tick of the grandfather clock, is, for whatever reason, one of the sharpest memories I have of this entire period. Studying the cracks in the paint on the door, standing so my feet lined up entirely within the floorboard. I had the feeling, and this was very likely delayed shock from our conversation, that we were acting out roles somehow, that the house was a set, and that there was an invisible audience somewhere that was watching both me standing waiting and Hannah in her office. I could feel them holding their breath. Now I heard Hannah's muffled voice leaving a message for Dr. Blythe. I could only get the tone, which was ordinary, cheerful, apologetic, not the least bit weepy, as if she were calling to let him know about a scheduling mix-up. When she finally stepped out into the hall, her eyes were dry, and she was making the same sheepish face she did sometimes after fights.
"Look at you standing there all freaked out," she said. "I'm fine."
She took my hand and led us back out into the yard to gather the decorations we'd dropped. It was hard to find the crayons and all the leaves. It had gotten even colder out.
"Thank you for taking care of me," she said. "I'll be fine."
Comment cards. Wright Historic House.
Anna McGlure, Poughkeepsie, New York. Very informative museum. Keep up the good work. Interesting encyclopedias. The garden space is nice.
David and Judy Diamond, Keene, New Hampshire. Stumbled on this little gem while visiting sister, Alice Sussler, free afternoon. Wish there had been a bit more detail regarding food and cooking, as I have great interest and expertise in food of the period, and would be glad to return to make a presentation, including preparing authentic recipes, if your schedule and budget permitted it. What a Chef at whatachefcatering.com.
Raymond Farkas, Pine Plains, New York. It has been years since I have had the privilege of visiting this fine little museum, despite the proximity, as life does intrude. Two back surgeries, one valve replacement, severe Lyme disease. Count me among the huzzas that you have not given in to those who would prefer to see you closed. I am a veteran of the U.S. Air Force, 51-55, Bronze Star, and I understand that history is complex and that sharing one man's story is a worthy and noble mission.
Brian Gumley, age 7, Hibernia, New York. The graves.
Spring 2020, New York, age 39. You are sitting in a glass cube. The air is damp. It smells like bleach. Other moms sit next to you in red chairs. They cross their legs, open their bags. You look out into the pool. Your son's swim class is in lane 3. You can hardly tell him from the others, little hairless bodies, big heads in red caps, blue kickboards, every sound, splash, whistle turned blurry at the edges. Your sandal hangs. Your knees look old. You didn't know knees could look old. The grout between the tiles is yellow. The flyer on the wall says, "Family swim on Saturday, all ages welcome." The mother next to you, whose name you've never learned, black hair is what you call her, she says, "People keep telling us Corey, and that's supposed to be just like marble, but you can actually spill on it," which, oh my God, can you imagine me telling Simon he's not allowed to spill? The back of your head hurts. It's hurt all afternoon. Strange you're only realizing this now. How many afternoons have you done this? How many hours have you sat in this chair, watched your son, watched the clock above the lifeguard's chair? You ask black hair, "Do you have Tylenol?" You realize from her face that she was saying something. You hope it wasn't important. She looks into her bag. She says, "I've only got these. Is that okay?" You say yes. You say, "Thanks. That's fine."
5. There's an impulse, I've noticed, once someone's gone, to comb through your memory for moments, the more recent the better, when that person last seemed perfectly normal. I just had dinner with him last week. I just got an email from her the other day. Part awe, I think, and part protest. But she was just here. Those next few weeks were full of these moments. The Halloween event, when Hannah wore her white sweater and knelt by the picnic table on the lawn helping the red-haired boy who'd spilled apple cider on his tracing paper. The afternoon when she stood talking in the entryway with the moldy-smelling man from Millbrook who was working on an article about defunct train lines. The morning when she was brushing her teeth and called for me to come quick. I can still hear her toothbrushing voice, stretched out, all vowels. And there was a hawk standing watch on top of the locust tree. Hannah had told me at various points in those weeks how much better she felt now that she was taking her medicine again. She'd made an appointment to see Dr. Blythe when we went back to the city for Thanksgiving. Sometimes, for no good reason, the internet just goes out. This was how I decided to think about what had happened to Hannah that October. The wedding, the move, the museum, her medicine, who knew how it was all interacting? In every system of sufficient complexity, there are periods of inexplicable and usually meaningless disruption. The night it happened, I fell asleep before Hannah did. I was 20 pages into a history of jazz my dad had given me, and each paragraph was like a stone barricade that my consciousness could just barely climb. Hannah stayed up for a while after me, going through her notebook. I remember the relief of her light going off. And then, some number of hours later, I woke up to find her fingers on the waistband of my boxers. This would happen occasionally, but not for a while that we would wake up into the act of sex. There was often an odd, impersonal ravenousness to it, as if our sleeping selves had made a rendezvous and our bodies were just the underlings. Sometimes we'd sink back into sleep afterward without having exchanged a single ordinary word. But this time, Hannah was fully awake. The moon must have been close to full, because when she pressed her forehead against mine, I could see her eyes. And I remember her seeming unusually deliberate, even as I was still half asleep. We are, I remember thinking, back in business. I can't, or anyway I won't, deconstruct the precise mechanics. But there was an emphatic quality to her movements, as if her hips and hands, her entire body, were a stamp pressing down with special force against a slip of paper. I love you, she said. And then when I answered with a grunt or a kiss, she said it again. I love you. Afterward, I slept like I'd been drugged. And when I woke up, the curtains were pale and Hannah's side of the bed was empty. Her notebook was gone from the bedside table. It was 8:34, late even for me. My plan for the morning had been to fix up a verse of the song I'd been working on. There was a mushy stretch passing through A minor that I thought I might be close to solving. And then to drive to the hardware store to get new light bulbs for the basement. Hannah's t-shirt and underwear were crumpled on the floor at the foot of the bed. Her bathrobe was draped over the back of the chair by the window where she usually sat and drank her coffee. I poured myself a bowl of Chex and walked with it out into the living room. Usually at 9 o'clock, Hannah would be setting up the museum, setting baskets of corn husks on each of the tables, counting out paper plates and pipe cleaners. I expected, after last night, for there to be a slight, tender sheepishness between us. I would put my hand on her shoulder and she'd smile, tell me to knock it off whether I was doing anything or not. But she wasn't in the living room, and she wasn't at her desk, and she wasn't on the porch. And she didn't respond when I called her name from the foot of the stairs. Maybe she'd gone to get milk. No, our car was still parked outside. Maybe she'd gone for a morning run. Except here were her sneakers, still muddy from the day before. Donna came in at 9:30. I knew from her sigh as she opened the door that it wasn't Hannah. And she said as soon as she was settled, "Where's the boss lady?" It was only when I heard myself say, "I'm not sure, actually," that it occurred to me that anything strange might be going on. I still wasn't worried, exactly. I expected Hannah to walk in at any minute, but the seed had been planted. I called her cell phone, since I couldn't find it in our room, but the line just rang. Maybe she'd turned it to silent. At 10 o'clock, a class of fourth graders showed up at the museum. Donna led them through candle-making. I went upstairs and opened each door, the whole time talking to myself, "Oh, Hannah, this is very weird," in that sing-songy way you do when you think someone might be hiding. Nothing, nothing, nothing. Butch was at the back of the house doing something to the hinges of the screen door. "I'm not sure where Hannah is," I told him in a voice that I meant to sound more curious than concerned. "Maybe she took a walk in the woods." I put on my jacket and walked out across the backyard, the same path we always took. It was a bright, clear day, fall photo shoot weather. I could hear the class back inside the house, Donna's voice repeating something. I walked past the birch trees left at the bird feeder and on to the muddy path through the woods. The stillness was bizarre. There wasn't a chipmunk, not even a bird. Just half-bare trees and the sound of my footsteps and the smell of decomposing leaves. When I came to the hill where Hannah and I had once eaten cheese sandwiches and clementines, I stopped and called her name, feeling slightly embarrassed, then turned back toward the house. Each thought I had started out as an absurdity. Could she have been attacked by a bear? Accidentally shot by a hunter? But then the more panicky parts of me would get a hold of it. jaws against that neck, her neck, blood in the corner of her mouth. Imagination is shameless. Suddenly, I was walking faster, and the hair on my arms was standing up. Your girlfriend, your fiancé, has started the day by going somewhere. That's it. A woman who has safely navigated 30 years of mornings is continuing the streak. She'll be standing in front of the class with Donna when you get back to the museum, and she won't be able to believe, if you even bother to tell her, what thoughts you were having while she was gone. But she wasn't in the living room. And Butch, who looked like he'd been waiting for me, said, "Nothing, huh? She ever go walking by the river or down toward 82? Fear, like laughter, is a social phenomenon. I got in the car. Hannah's green jacket was still in the passenger seat. A brochure from the Dutchess County Fair was crumpled on the floor. And drove down Culver about as slowly as a person running. Past the house with the corn crib. Past the house with the Repeal the Safe Act sign. Past the fallen barn. I looked through woods, up people's driveways, over big empty fields. I thought about rolling down the window to call her name, and realized that this was an impulse borrowed from looking for lost dogs. A young mother came jogging out of her driveway with a kid in a stroller, and we exchanged waves as if I were heading to the post office. Then the thought occurred to me, Hannah's parents. Maybe they'd come to pick her up. I imagined them driving up at dawn, having decided to make one last plea for her not to marry me. It made more sense than anything else I'd thought of. I pulled onto the grass by the side of the road to see if I had reception so I could call the Rampies. But what if she wasn't with them? What would I tell them then? The dashboard clock said it was 10:59. Curiosities slide into idle fears, slide into terrors without there being any clear points of demarcation. I think I still would have guessed, if forced to bet, that nothing serious had happened, that I'd forgotten an appointment she'd told me about, or that she'd gone on a bizarrely long walk, or that a neighbor had invited her over. The lifetime batting average of my worried mind was infinitesimal. But back at the house, the school kids and their bus were gone, and Donna and Butch were standing by the front window in the living room looking concerned. "Not to get into you all's business," Donna said. "But you weren't having some kind of fight or anything? When I was little, my mom used to sometimes take off for a whole day, let my dad just sweat it out." Butch kept stepping out of the room, and I realized he was making phone calls from Hannah's office. "Well," I heard him say, "it's just strange." "Yep. Uh-huh. Appreciate it." "Oh, yoo-hoo," Donna called out toward the back of the house. "Doesn't it feel like she's just maybe hiding in the basement or something?" Butch came back in and said, "I just talked to Jean down at the farm stand. She'll keep an eye out." Then, a few minutes later, after another call, "That was my buddy Ed, over on Charwell. He hikes Culver Mountain most mornings, and he said he didn't see anybody." So, a search party. Each time the museum phone rang, I'd think for an idiotic instant that it was certain to be Hannah, but each time it would be some well-meaning neighbor with nothing to say. "Was she maybe doing something in one of the schools?" "And did you see her leave the house?" Sitting at the activity table felt like being in a hospital waiting room, except with the knowledge that what we were doing might turn out to be ridiculous. A young woman with a tote bag walked in at 12:30. She was a senior at Bard, and she'd made an appointment the week before to speak with Hannah about volunteer opportunities. Donna took her around, showed her the study. I paced between our room and the activity room, putting off the moment of calling Hannah's parents, going over to the fridge every few minutes to eat a spoonful of peanut butter or a few bites of congealed, oily pasta. I was as hungry as I'd ever been in my life. I finally did call Hannah's mom.
"Do you think we should drive up?"
she said, sounding more confused than anything else. And when I told her no, it was probably nothing, she said,
"I'm sure you're right, but do have her call us."
At 1:30, the museum phone rang again for the first time in an hour. I was by the front window. Butch was in Hannah's office.
"Mm-hmm,"
I heard him say.
"Mm-hmm. Yeah? Whereabouts? Okay,
He hung up and walked out toward me. Even now, it physically hurts to remember this. I once dislocated my shoulder playing football in Norwood Park, and I remember as I was lying in the dust with Brendan Wexler standing over me, I thought, there's something almost beautiful about how much this hurts. The pain had sophisticated patterning, a distinctive shape. It was like an iceberg exploding in slow motion in my nervous system. Remembering that moment of Butch coming out of the office feels like that.
That was Mary Clower, he said. Says she might have seen something a little ways down the river.
I speed walked with Butch, neither of us talking. We walked back from the museum, over the stony yellow hills, and then down along the riverbank 5 or 10 minutes, which is plenty of time for me to have tortured myself with every possible thing that could have happened. But I can't remember what I actually thought about. Did I know already at some depth? Was I terrified? Hopeful? Or was I so focused on getting there that the entire walk was just an adrenalized, mindless blur, like a parent racing to grab a toddler out of the road? Mary Clower stood waiting for us between the back of her house and the river. I'd never seen her before. She had on jeans and a flannel shirt, and she had the long gray hair of someone who cares deeply about horses. What she'd seen, it turned out, was a canoe washed up on shore. She pointed to it now. It was flipped over on its back, red and brown, unmistakably the museum's, buried enough in reeds that I might have missed it. The last time I'd seen it, it had been leaning against the tree where it always lived, and Hannah had made me come look at a spider web on one of the oars.
I was just going for a walk, then I saw it, and I thought, 'cause I'd heard from Jean that somebody was missing, hey, that's a little weird.
My internal temperature had plummeted such that my teeth were now chattering.
Hannah ever go out paddling?
Butch said. I told him, yes, a few times.
Could also have been a kid or something pushed it out though, right? You all just kept it over in the woods somewhere.
Yes, back farther upstream, I said. Behind the tree. There's something particularly awful about feeling terror on a sunny afternoon. Hawks were circling way overhead. The river was smooth and coffee-colored. I walked a few feet down the riverbank and touched the water with my fingers. It was cold, but not freezing. This is, I told myself, a river that 9-year-olds safely paddle down without getting their bologna sandwiches wet. This is a river that Hannah called a glorified creek. I could actually hear my heartbeat. I don't know if I'd ever experienced true, sustained panic before. I understood now why people might run back into burning buildings, or how people could forget in moments of crisis how to dial a phone. I don't think I could have added 3 and 4 right then. I'm not sure I could have told you my full name. There is, of course, a shameful excitement to these kinds of scenes. Not for me, but for Mary Clower and for the neighbors who'd now wandered back out of their houses. They were buzzing, conferring, going inside to make phone calls. I'd felt it before, myself, watching fire trucks swoop to a stop, witnessing a mugging. Their disaster, your adventure. A stork-looking man came out from one of the stone houses. He was cleanly bald, frowning, and announced that he was going to get his kayak from his garage. Butch was standing in a patch of grass a few yards downriver, looking out toward the opposite shore. I heard Donna saying to someone, "Who would think about going canoeing in November, though?" I leaned against a boulder by the shore, facing away from the river, wondering if there was any way I could make myself pass out and then be woken up once all this was over. After some number of minutes, the stork man came dragging his kayak across his yard, and then, some number of minutes after that, he came back from his exploratory paddle, clambering up the shore, his paddle on his shoulder.
"Nothing doing that I saw," he said. "I went maybe 500 yards up and back."
I stood up to say something, but then I realized that I might actually be about to faint, which suddenly seemed not at all desirable. Butch put a hand on my shoulder and said, "Why didn't we walk back up to the museum?"
"We're gonna find her, buddy," Butch said.
"I know," She'd been gone for at least 7.5 hours. My shoes were muddy and my hands were shaking. I made the decision right there on the crest of the hill. If she was okay, if she was at the museum, we were going to get married immediately. Forget invitations, forget caterers. We'd drive to the courthouse that afternoon, never be out of each other's sight again. No, she was nowhere inside. You can feel when a house is empty the same way you can feel when a TV is off. I walked back into our room. Her robe was still hanging over the back of her chair. Her wallet was still on the dresser. Someone you love going missing is a tightening vice. Each second of understanding that this has actually happened, and that any possible resolution is not going to be one you like, is another twist. "I'm going to call the sheriff," Butch said. That, I think, was when the vice twisted tight enough that something happened to my breathing, or to my brain. Suddenly there was a high whining sound in my ears, and an extra layer of distance between me and everything around me. I sat down in the chair by the welcome desk and pressed my fingertips against my eyelids. "Since either late last night or early this morning," I half heard Butch say. "She may have gone out on the river. Why don't you go ahead and send as many folks as you can spare?" The sheriff pulled into the museum's driveway in a car that actually said "Sheriff" on the door. He had sunglasses hanging from his collar and a belly like the prow of a ship. Explaining to him and his two deputies what had happened forced me to get myself more or less together. "What you want," he said, pulling a backpack from his car, "is to try to find her before the sun goes down." The next half hour was all cars pulling into the driveway and along the road, as if there were going to be a party. Don and Jean from the farm stand, Butch's wife and his 20-something son, who looked just like Butch except thinner and with a crown of thorns tattoo on the back of his neck. The checkout woman from Peck's with the hairline smoking wrinkles all around her mouth. Barry, the head writer. A handful of people I'd never seen before. I felt in serious danger of bursting into desperation and gratitude-induced tears. Sheriff Cole divided us up into teams. He sent some of us back down to the river, some of us into the woods west of the house, some of us out along the road. He distributed walkie-talkies, one per group. He assigned me to the woods, along with a grandmotherly woman and a scoutmasterish goateed man. While we walked, dead wet leaves everywhere, bare tree trunks, coffee bean clusters of deer poop, the scoutmaster kept stopping to whistle with both pinkies in his mouth, as loud a sound as I'd ever heard a person make. I felt a general gelatin-boned shakiness that I think must have been adrenaline poisoning.
"This is going to turn out just fine," the grandmotherly woman told me. "My son once went missing for a full night, dinner to breakfast. I imagine Hannah might just have gone off for a walk by herself and not told anybody."
Every single rock, bird, half-rotten tree stump seemed for a millisecond like it could be Hannah, crouching down to tie her shoe, standing behind a tree. I kept thinking I felt my cell phone buzz, which I didn't. There was no reception in the woods. But still, each time my heart would leap, and I'd tear my phone out of my pocket thinking I'd see Hannah on the screen, and the whole nightmare would dissolve. The scoutmaster said I was looking a little gray, and made me eat a few bites of a granola bar that he pulled out from one of his many pockets. I had a vision of him, for some reason, with a full emergency kit in the trunk of his car, leaping out to set up road flares around a minor accident. "You just finish that up," he said. "You want to hold on to something. You all right?" Every 15 or 20 minutes, my panic, despair would be pierced by a voice saying that this was all insane. Us tromping around the woods, splashing into the river, that I'd dragged half the county in to witness the breaking of an engagement. Because that, more and more, was how I thought this was going to end. Her shame-faced reappearance, a weeping fight, a U-Haul. Maybe that emphatic middle-of-the-night sex had been her goodbye. Maybe she'd met someone else.
As soon as I had the thought, it was like lock tumblers falling into place. Of course she'd met someone. The sleeplessness, the shiftiness, the guilt. It was the only way any of it made sense. I felt a spike of such sharp relief thinking of it that I had to hold on to a tree. This wasn't a life disaster. This was a romantic disaster. She was walking teary-eyed by the side of the road, or, God help me, she was off fucking someone, in a motel or in a back seat. Maybe the organic farmer with the Adam's apple. Maybe one of the writers. Anyone, please, just please let her be alive and not dead. I'd be furious, humiliated, devastated, but, oh, God, I would collapse to my knees with gratitude. It would be the most wonderful day of my life. I scrambled the half mile through the woods back up to the museum, my lungs burning, and called Hannah's phone again from the phone in her office. It rang and rang, and I heard each ring as an event with a beginning, a middle, and an end. You've reached Hannah Rampe. Hannah, if you're getting this, I don't care what you're doing. I don't care who you're with. You need to call back. You need to call back right now. I'm completely freaked out and... I waited a minute and called again in case she'd heard my message and had a change of heart. You've reached Hannah Rampe. Back down in the woods where my group was now walking up a rocky hill along a dry, stony creek bed, the prospect of sunset, it was now 5 o'clock, had started giving an extra urgency to things. Sheriff Cole walkie-talkied everyone to say that we should regroup back at the museum if we hadn't found anything by 6. There were, through the treetops, a couple of pale stars out already. There was wind rattling the few leaves still hanging on. Hannah and I would usually have been in our room with the radio on, maybe splitting a beer, deciding whether to drive to Peck's or just to cook with what we had. There was now, there are terror cycles, just like there are sleep cycles, such a deadness in my limbs that I wasn't sure I could keep moving. I felt minutes away from collapsing into the leaves. There was no possible way I was going to be able to survive it. If searching for her went on all night, then all day tomorrow. But there was also no possible way it was going to end any sooner than that. The places she could be were so many. The places we could look were so few. I imagined Sheriff Cole setting up a tent on the front yard with cots in it, like they have at disaster sites. We'd sleep in shifts. Maybe the Poughkeepsie police would loan us a helicopter. Hannah's face would be on the news. I'd spend the rest of my life stapling flyers to telephone poles, wandering median strips. No. The group that found her was farther down the river than Sheriff Cole had told anyone to search, past the swimming hole where we'd skinny-dipped. The call came through at 5:50, just dark enough that the woods and air were starting to turn blue and smudged. The group had gone outside the walkie-talkie's range, so one of them, Butch's son, had had to run back a bit, which explained some of how his voice sounded when it came through. We found her. We found her. We're about 300 yards down the river. He didn't have to say whether she was okay. All of our faces fell together, as if a handful of strings had been snipped. Without thinking about it, or even realizing that I was doing it, I ran back through the woods and across the fields and down the riverbank, hopping over brambles, climbing fallen trees, squelching through mud, nearly falling in. I was in incredible pain, all over my body. But my legs weren't heavy anymore. I could have leapt over a car. I was making a steady, rumbly groan. When I finally came to Butch's son, his jeans and shirt were soaked. He'd been fully in the river. His neck was streaked with mud. I stopped, panting, trying to get out the words, "Where is she?" And Sheriff Cole, who I hadn't noticed running beside me, stepped in front of me to block my view. "Take a seat, right here," he said, pushing me down onto a tree stump. He was shaking too, and panting. "You just wait right here. We'll get her." There were other people around me now. Donna and the scoutmaster, and Jean from the farm stand. More people, all pressing on my shoulders, petting my head, squeezing my hands. Someone told me to close my eyes, and I did. I heard, a little ways off, someone splashing out into the river, something like branches breaking, some kind of conversation, more splashing. That may have been when I started wailing, almost screaming, a sound I would never have recognized as coming from me. The hands were pressing harder against me now, and I thought in the part of me that was still observing, like a guillotined head's blinking eyes. This is the sound a person makes when he's burning alive. Part 2.
Edmund Wright's Journal. October 3rd. The events of the night have left me troubled to my toes. Shortly after supper, I retreated to my office for a final grapple with the morning's pages. I sat at my desk, just as I sit now, with my left elbow upon the table and my left temple upon my fist, just so. The moon hung in the window's corner. Sarah and her dishes clattered companionably below. As I became consumed in the rhythms of my work, I grew conscious, dimly, of a strange sound somewhere in the room behind me. A cursory look persuaded me that I had been subject to one of perception's manifold illusions, but in the ensuing quarter hour, the sound, rather like breathing or distant chatter, persisted, and my bare animal sense, both more elusive and more reliable than hearing, insisted that there was indeed a presence in my study, and that my very looking had been the cause of its earlier dissolution. Carefully, then, oh so carefully, I set down my pen, and I made myself like a creature of prey in a meadow, still and abuzz with the readiness to perceive. Here the figure came, then, closer, now closer, seeming not so much to tread as to flow across the room. The flesh between my shoulder blades now fairly quivered. When the figure was, by my body's reckoning, close enough to reach my neck, the sound of its breathing, the very imprint of its presence, identified itself to my inmost apparatus, and I leapt. It was William. Helpless now to restrain myself, I spun around in my chair, and in so doing, I scattered being and sensation both. I had evidently let out a cry, for Sarah called my name from the foot of the stairs, and I replied, in tones of willful muscularity, that it had been nothing. Pardon me, that all was well. And so it seemed. My study showed nothing uncommon, and after some minutes I returned to my papers, telling myself that I had received a dispatch not from my son, but from some ordinarily unreachable depths of my psyche, made accessible by exhaustion. Yet the experience lingered, and lingers still, rebuking me, imploring me to trust my senses and not my reason. What a fool I would be if, out of fear and obstinate materialism, I failed to redeem in the currency of understanding the profoundest loss of my life. Thus does a man of science set down his tools and become once more one for whom the world contains wonders both terrible and incomprehensible. How fervently, waiting here once more in the dark, do I both dread and long for William's return.
1. There's a moment after you wake up from a nightmare when you realize, wait, so I don't have to worry about any of that. Those days right after Hannah died were the opposite of that, only over and over and over again. It's true. It actually happened. This is now my life. I can't really say now whether I actually believed that Hannah's death had been an accident, or if this was just the workings of my psychological immune system trying to protect me from taking on too many agonizing thoughts at once. Anyway, I was too staggered in the immediate aftermath to do much coherent thinking. I was at my full capacity, just trying to navigate a single block